Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dominaria's Judgment. I'm Ari Lax. Dom is off battling in the actual literal Pro Tour, probably about the time that this gets posted. But we have a backup plan, as always, and we have dialed the Jarvis for this week. Hello, Jarvis. How's it going?
It's going great. You know, I'm happy to be here in Dom's stead, and we wish him the best of luck in the Pro Tour.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens with that, and we'll have some speculation here, but we figured since we are the lowly plebs who have not managed to find our way out to Minneapolis, we'll talk about the formats that maybe impact a little bit more of the population, which are the RCQ formats, which my understanding are Pioneer and Limited for the next little bit.
Yeah, I believe there's a local person who like curates all of the, you know, events because there's not a central calendar. I believe there's like 2 sealed deck and like 15 Pioneer that have been posted so far.
Yeah, you know what, I'm not even going to get into the whole thing about not being able to know what events are occurring and when, but I assure you that every single person is going through their own form of that wonderful challenge. And, you know, it's a gating mechanism. It's like each RCQ is basically like a qualifier that you had to qualify for by finding the event.
Yeah, the one nice thing about this season and that I found pretty stressful about last season was last season people could run whatever they want. So it didn't sync up with the RC that was incoming, whereas this season is Pioneer, and the DreamHack that this doesn't qualify for, if you are already qualified, does happen to be Pioneer. So you don't really have to like switch formats every week, you know, be like, okay, does my modern deck make sense? Does my Pioneer deck make sense? Has anything new happened? It was kind of stressful, and that actually caused me to like not focus as well on San Diego as maybe I would have liked, because Standard was not one of the formats that was really run before that event as well.
Yeah, the multi-format challenge has been a long-running one where testing for 2 constructed formats at the same time is just basically impossible. But, it's worked out for you. And it sounds like you don't really have to worry about any of that because you did win an RCQ last weekend.
Yeah, it's funny. I would say it felt a lot like an old PTU up into including where the finals was just me, my opponent, and the judge, and everyone else had left. It was a 77-person one slaughter, so it was going to be like that by the end, pretty much all the time. So it was kind of a funny throwback in that regard.
Yeah, I was going to say that's even more sparse because usually at an old PTQ, you would have the people in your car stuck with you. But since everything is a little more localized, it's probably a little easier to just have yourself in the car.
Yeah, and also I looked at the timing of it. So I decided right before Top 8 started, I was going to go get a chicken sandwich / eat dinner. And I was right to do that because by the time it ended, it was like 9:30 and everything was basically closed. So I didn't have to do that sort of stuff before if tournaments started early enough, but this one started at like noon and, you know, there's always delays. So I had a feeling this was going to happen, you know?
Yeah. Big memories of my first PTQ win victory dinner was Taco Bell on the way home off of the Ohio highway.
But yeah, I guess y'all are sort of interested in what I played. I did play Rakdos, but I kind of think fundamentally a lot of the Rakdos lists you see on Goldfish are not really built with a coherent plan or even good cards in mind, really, is my issue with the deck. I don't know. I guess you also have a long and storied career of playing Mutavault and Thoughtseize in the same deck. Let me tell you, those cards are still really, really good together.
Are people cutting those? Because it seemed like that was the big development of the last bit, and just like cutting those is dumb.
So my issue is
Mutavault specifically, I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. What my issue is, what looked like happened was, okay, people are like, oh my god, Shuda's deck looks incredible. The mana base looks great. A few months go by, and then we're just back to the misplayed ginger, like 2-3 castle walk lane, not enough swamps for the castle to come and play untapped. And well, one thing I've been beating the drum on is I feel pretty strongly that you should just play 4 Shieldred in the format because I think it's good in basically every matchup except maybe green and sometimes Lotus Field.
I mean, even Lotus Field, they often have to answer it when it resolves. Like any hand that involves pouring, it's kind of dicey. Right.
It kind of depends. Suffice it to say is I think most of the matchups it's a pretty good card, and usually if they manage to kill the first one, the thing you want to draw the most is the second one. And also in that regard, if you play the mana base that Misplaced Stranger has, I don't think you have enough untapped lands to operate turns 1-4 like you want to in a modern game of Magic. And I also think trying to activate Castle Octane in the face of my four Shieldreds or a Bankbuster is kind of a losing battle, unless if you actually have removal for all the Shieldreds.
Yeah, I do. I'm with you. I have not seen an untapped Castle Octane like basically ever, and I don't really understand when you are. The matchups where you are activating it are ones where you should already be favored, like Azorius Control. Like the Rakdos deck in general is just systematically favored against Azorius. It's really hard. Like the matchups tend towards things like the 5C midrange deck where Castle Lockthwain can be activated, but like if their deck is built properly, they're playing too big of a game at that point of the game for that to really matter. Or like, you know, things that are just going to go under it. Like, are you going to activate Castle Lockthwain against, I mean, maybe Greasefang, but that's the point of the game where you should have already asserted dominance.
Yeah, I don't think the Greasefang matchup is about drawing more cards than them. The way my deck is built, it's about sticking a Shieldred, hiding behind it until they die.
Yeah, Shieldred does that. I mean, you just play a single threat, yeah, and then your opponent eventually loses the entire game. Yeah, I completely agree with you on just, like, I don't really understand what Castle Lockthwain is attempting to accomplish. And my understanding is you won at least one match this tournament by not putting your Urborg on the battlefield, and I kind of want to say that I'm not...
Right.
Like... I'm just like generally not sold on the Urborg, but I understand the need for it with Mutavolts.
Right. I think the Urborg thing, it's kind of questionable if it should be in the deck for sure. One thing I would like to note, if you actually expect Rogues to be a big deck, you might want to rejigger the mana and get it 1-2 Crooks back in. Because if you play the single or two copy of that card, the Rogues deck just literally doesn't function versus you. Like, none of their cards do anything and they'll die to Crooksa.
Yeah, I mean, in Standard, we had this whole thing where, like, the Rogues deck could beat these cards, but, like, as the power level of your opponent's deck scales, the less you can actually handle a good escape card. Like, my recollection was that the Gruul matchup, if your opponent had Phoenix of Ash, was a disaster.
That sounds about right. But, yeah, basically, all I'm going to say is I think Rakdos is pretty good. I almost... the last... Pioneer RCQ before the season shifted, I actually did play Greasefang because I thought there was like a hole I could exploit in the metagame. And I actually did make top 8 of the tournament pretty easily. Then I lost to Esper Loot Tree Control. And that made me realize one thing I didn't really like about Greasefang is all of your control matchups kind of suck. The more controlling your opponent's deck is, the harder it is for you to win, because I think like at the end of the day, like those decks are just so good at killing creatures that it's hard for you to even kill them with like Chariots or whatever, unless if you play like four Lilianas or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk a bit about Greasefang in general, because the deck did go through a relatively significant rebuild after the last Pro Tour, and I'm just generally still not impressed with it. I think that it's not even a matter of consistency, it's just the deck is fundamentally like, what happens if your opponent goes full press disruption on you, and your deck doesn't do a lot if your opponent is just prepared for Chariot and Skyboat.
I think one of the conceits of the deck is that not a lot of decks are prepared to play against Thoughtseize into Chariot, into Skyboat, into maybe just turn 3 Parhelion you. But I'm not even sure that's true anymore. I've also been beating the drum of playing Graveyard Hate in basically all of the decks I play because of not just Greasefang, but also Neoform to a lesser degree. I think if you take out their graveyard, it's actually pretty hard for them to win. Like, if Rakdos Leylines Neoform, how the heck do they ever win? Like, just think about that.
Yeah, the Neoform deck, I think, is just generally built under the conceit that you are going to resolve a Delve creature at some point of the game, and if you don't, then that's bad. Most of the hate that people are playing for graveyards is not Leyline of the Void. Sure. It's just literally Leyline is the problem.
I was going to play 3 Leyline and 1 Hearse for this tournament. Then I realized the way I wanted to like map my sideboard, I didn't have enough slots for that. So I just played 2 Hearse instead, because it's kind of hard to justify playing only 2 Leyline when you're less likely to have it in your opener. Whereas Hearse, like, it's easier to draw and like maneuver around it on like the midterms of a game, you know?
You don't ascribe to the classic Jerry Thompson single ley line plan?
Not in Pioneer. I mean, if I had literally one slot, I might do it. But since I have two slots, I would rather just play two Hearths, I think.
Okay, you just want the like slightly more consistent plan against decks that are sort like, I guess, are there, what decks are specifically the sort of graveyard decks where you would prefer a Hearth? Or are you also sort of interested in Hearth versus like rogues to manage your own graveyard?
That hadn't come up for me. I haven't played the matchup, but I probably would side in. A lot of the matchups I also play against, you know, just weird things like the Creativity Gear Hulk deck. If you play Hearth against them, their deck also doesn't function weirdly enough. I think it just does a lot of small things in the metagame that make it pretty appealing right now. I think in general, Graveyard Hate is extremely good right now. It's good versus Greasefang. It's good versus Phoenix if people show up with that. It's good versus Neoform to a lesser degree, although like obviously they can still delve through it at some point. And it's definitely, you know, like you can just see it. I think basically there's like three or four decks where it's extremely effective, and then you'll find a lot of small uses for the card that makes it worth playing some number of Hearths at the moment.
Are you willing to have Hearth as like a slow growing creature against control, or is that just kind of out of range for this format?
So I thought about that. I think it's good for Greasefang to do that, but Rakdos doesn't have to bother with that given its threat density.
Yeah.
Like, especially with the three Mutavaults and like three creature lands besides that, and all of my discard, I don't really think there's room for Hearth in my deck versus them. Because basically all my cards are already live. Like, I just have a million things that are super annoying for them. Like, probably my worst card versus control decks is like Bone Crusher Giant, and that's still, you know, a fine card.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Misery Shadow, right?
Oh, which sure.
Like a pretty low quality too, but if you just look at, you know, I'm just bringing up your list here in between all the pictures of Rubens that you post. and I think that, like, leaning into, like, Go Blank, Kolaghan's Command, Duress is rather effective against all the control decks in the format because they are largely, like, expensive threat decks that actually need all of their cards because they need to make all of their land drops.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, this heavy decision to attack your opponent's hand is pretty acceptable. Yeah, there's not a ton of dead cards going on here. The
only card I didn't literally touch was Stamping Sphere, but I think it's okay to have like the Nuclear option versus Lotus Field.
Yeah, well, I mean, how much Lotus Field have you seen these days? Because it's been fairly quiet in the challenges, but I don't quite know if that is a result of like Pioneer Magic Online players just being done with it, or like the fact that no one has shown up to a Pioneer Pro Tour. I know that that's been like a big thing, is like every time there is a big high stakes Pioneer event, people start busting out the Lotus Fields, but like it feels like it kind of lulls in between those.
I think what a large portion of it is, like, you don't have random people choosing to pick up Lotus Field. Like, that just doesn't happen. Basically, people who play that deck just want to play combo, I think, generally speaking. So I'm mostly scared of the good combo players playing that deck, because I think that is legitimately not a great matchup for Rakdos, generally speaking. Because, like, it's difficult to kill them in time, or they establish enough mana to, like, do their tooth and nail, essentially.
Yeah, you're scared of the games where they just make seven mana and cast an ultimatum and the game ends.
Yeah, tooth and nail.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, that one costs nine. So I guess you having not played against Rogues means that you don't really have an opinion on whether Rogues is a deck. I am beyond skeptical of that deck being functional. Mm-hmm. Do you share that basic principle? Or?
Well, the one thing I looked at, like, just fundamentally speaking, I don't see how this deck can have a good matchup versus Rakdos. That's like the most popular deck in basically all of the Pioneer tournaments. So the litmus test is, I would at least like my deck to be acceptable versus Rakdos, and it feels like that deck fundamentally fails that, because you're just an all small creature deck with a bunch of low impact cards. Like, in my mind, Rakdos should like tear you apart basically every game.
Yeah, I'm just like generally skeptical where I would want these cards instead of just playing Rakdos, and the only answer would be like if you believe Drawn in the Lock is a good card against Lotus Field. I don't even think that's true.
Doesn't Lotus Field not really like put many cards in its graveyard? So the thing, yeah, Drown in the Lock is like
You start, like, you know, you're Thieves Guild Enforcer, and they got to put two lands in there. Maybe you can get to seven. I need someone else to explain this to me, because I have not figured it out myself.
And isn't the other issue that, like, okay, you have all of your permission post board, and the Lotus Fields player's ready for you. They're just like, all right, here I got this Dragon Lord Jamoka or Thought Distortion. To, like, pick your six drop poison of choice and get killed by it.
Well, I think Thought Distortion is noticeably worse against rogues than it is against any other deck in the format, right? Because you might just, like, Thought Distortion them, and it's basically a bad duress, and they just take that turn that you spent and go all, like, cast more things and kill you. Yeah.
Well, the Jamoka thing seems pretty problematic, because
you can drown a Jamoka once it resolves.
Do you think they'll have six cards in graveyard by that point?
Again, you sacrifice two lands to Lotus Field, and then all you need is, like, a Thieves Guild Enforcer.
Well, I was told that a bunch of the green players are pretty scared of rogues, but I'm not even sure how true that is with Polukernos Reborn in the mix. But, you know, kind of hard to suss that one out. In any case, I also think you should look at the players who are winning with rogues, because if it's all names you recognize, then I don't think that's a good sign for the deck. Basically, I noticed this effect, like, way back when worst players win consistently with the deck, like, repeatedly, and you can't really understand why, that's when I want to pay attention to a deck. If it's just, like, a great player winning with rogues, that doesn't really mean much to me, personally.
Yeah, I think that there's a distinction to be made there with, like, worst players and, like, people who have specialized in that specific sub-archetype. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, I think the best example of this would be, like, Craig Wesco, definitely not a worst player, but often wins with decks, you know, back in the day that were not playable by a lot of other players, just because, you know, he knew how to play white aggressive creatures very well. And I think that there's something to be said about, like, you know, if you look at the Magic Online results and you see, oh, Tybalt of Red Sub is winning with Mill, that shouldn't really influence your decision to play Mill.
Well, it's like if Reed has a 5-0 with Modern Jund, I would basically tell anyone else, please stay the hell away from this deck. Like, it's mostly not very good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to diss Modern Jund right now, because it feels like the lists are coming to somewhere that is much more reasonable and the format is somewhat slowing down. But yes, I think if you are describing Jund as Bloodbraid Elves and not Urza Sagas, then yes.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Good. I'm glad we agree on that front. I guess going down the other Pioneer decks, I don't think a ton has changed with Mono Green. It feels like it's largely the same deck with some Polukernoses, which maybe matter if you're playing Azorius Spirits. Every so often, we see a message from Bobby that is basically like, so my current sideboard plan cuts all the traditional black sources, such as Haywire Might and the Stone Brain and Ratchet Bomb / Filigree Silix. But I have found the secret black source of, like, having a second Cityscape Leveler. And I, you know, I'm going to let everyone who plays Mono Green that deep keep doing that.
Well, I want to dissect what you said real quick. I think the extra 4-power creatures for Kiora actually matter quite a bit in my experience, having watched the new version play out. And also, it's just kind of nice to have, like, additional threat density. Because I think something that could happen was, like, you would just draw too much air in the deck and not enough, like, impactful things on the early turn. Like, a GGG 4-5, even if it's not the best in some matchups, it basically always has text in this deck. And sometimes it's even better than that. Like, you flip it, and then you have Wurmcoil Engine versus, like, a mono-red deck. Like, what the hell are they going to do about that? They'll need, like, 5 Atarka's Commands to beat you or something like that.
Yeah, my thing with that is that I don't... There are relatively few matchups with Mono Green where the problem is, like, having a functional normal card. I think you are a lot more polarized in spots where, like, you have the Lotus Field matchup where there's a card in your deck that matters. Mm-hmm. Or, like, the, you know, you have Polukernos in your deck, but your opponent is, like, a mono red deck that isn't really interacting with your main game plan of, you know, getting to Nykthos, and Polukernos is relatively the same as Lovestruck Beast. Or, like, I guess it's maybe the Rakdos matchup where it's a slight upgrade to whatever you would have in that slot.
It's Rakdos matchup. One big gain was in the Greasefang matchup because.
Oh yes, we should talk about that, because that is just another big problem for Greasefang. I think is that it's very possible that you generate a Parhelion and it's not good enough.
Right, because what happens if they have Pulchronos is they only take 9, so that means the Parhelion returns to your hand. You have one Angel left. It's not actually very easy to kill them in a timely fashion from that, and that's like with them not even having a Karn out or whatever, you know, which is like the actual winning game state for green, in my opinion. But like now they can just make two or three reach creatures and then you never kill them, and then they always win the long game because their deck is like an engine deck that can produce, like, you know, drawing its entire deck or whatever, however you want to see it.
Yeah. The 4-5 reach versus 4-5 vigilance angel lineup is not great. Maybe the big deal is that these decks that have not really been the very top of the modern metagame, but you are clawing percentage back against the small ball creature decks that aren't red in the same way, where like your mono white and spirits opponents are now being forced to contest the battlefield a lot faster than if it was just like Cavalier every game. Like mono white specifically, I know the games where your opponent had turned to Old Growth Troll were some of the problem games, just because the game would then come down to whether you could deal 20 damage as opposed to like chip shotting through 12 with Brave the Elements. But like, I think that is a pretty big change, but at the same time, I mean, I guess you played against mono white in the finals of your RCQ, but
yeah.
I have not seen a lot of that deck lately.
My opponent's version was kind of weird too. Like they had Ossification and Knight Captain of the Convoker, the 4 and a white one. And it looks like he had the maximum number because he like casts 2 versus me. Like, and that's very unlikely to happen unless if you have 4 in your deck, I think. Because it just happened pretty quickly. Unfortunately for him, my game 3 hand was phenomenal. Like, I actually had a hand that was unaffected by Thalia on the draw, which is kind of insane to think about. It was like 3 lands, Bone Crusher, Cletus, Shieldred, my 1 of Cletus in the sideboard obviously coming in. I drew, I think, Blood Tithe Harvester on turn 2. So I just like cast a creature every turn until my opponent died to my broken 4 drops.
Yeah, shockingly, the mono white all creatures deck is a little weak when its opponent is just casting better creatures every turn, which again is back to the Pulchronos thing. What is kind of happening there?
Well, for mono white, I'm not really sure. I think some of the plan is to play the ossifications like the Japanese player had at that PT. Like, my opponent had ossification in their deck as well. I don't even know what they cut because it looked like they had Brave, Ossification, and the Convoker. So it's kind of weird to think about.
Well, so I'm looking at Magic Online lists, and there are some that exist that have Brave and Ossification. So fitting in the Convoker is probably just a matter of like shaving down on some of the lower impact ones or whatever. Sure. Honestly, I could see an argument for trimming on Thalia, but that's just my personal hatred of the card. Or maybe it's just a metagame where you think you would rather have a way to draw cards than Brutal Cathar.
Yeah, that's kind of counterintuitive to playing Ossification and no Brutal Cathar, but I guess Ossification is a much safer card, minus like the Bosejus that can kill.
Also it. Cheaper. Like the fact that you're adding Night Captain means you may want to trim down on high drops. Sure. Yeah.
But at the same time, like I feel like being able to find Brutal Cathar off the Night Captain is worth something. So I don't know. It's kind of weird to figure out. I don't really have any interest in playing mono white or figuring it out. But I do like looking at deck lists, and it seems like some sort of internal tension with how the decks are built.
How so?
Well, just like all of these pieces, how many are you supposed to have? Like, are you sure you're supposed to play Ossification over Brutal Cathar? Are you sure cutting Brave the Elements is good? Because in my mind, Brave is one of the better cards in the deck as well. Like, I don't really know why you would play the deck if you're not playing Max Brave, or I guess it's just a great game one card is the reality. So I don't know. I just a lot to think about, I guess, with regards to that deck.
Yeah, well, I think my biggest issue is that I am largely not, so the deck was bad coming out of the like RCQ Pro Tour era, just because things got really bad for low-end creature decks. And I largely don't see any of the trends reversing in that fashion. Like, people are still playing a bunch of Rakdos. There's still a decent amount of creativity with, like, specifically the Fiery Impulses out of that deck. Mm-hmm. The white deck is not phenomenal against Greasefang in my experience, where, like, your baseline plan is not really well lining up against their plan. So you're just kind of like a deck relying on putting hate cards into your linear deck, which has kind of felt sketchy. Like, there's a lot of, like, stuff like that, and I don't think any of it's changed. Really, I mean, the headline story is that if you look at the top decks now versus the top decks a week after the last Pro Tour, the only thing that has changed is that, like, creativity has moved down the list, right?
Yeah, and that's maybe a red herring, because I think, in reality, the, like, combo creativity deck is much worse versus Rakdos than the Gearhulk version is, which is kind of a shift. Obviously, a deck with four Torrential Gearhulks and, like, a bunch of grindy cards is actually okay versus Rakdos. I actually had the displeasure of playing that matchup a bunch because a friend of mine asked me to play just the matchup. It did not feel very winnable for Rakdos, frankly. Like, the problem is the games just last so long, so they eventually just get to cast their, like, 5-6. Like, you can kill it, but that's not the issue. Like, if they've ever flashback Magmem Opus, the game is over.
Yeah, I mean, Divided by Zero feels like the kind of card that is just against Rakdos. Just your deck full of all threes and fours just getting hit with Divided by Zero on a key turn is like, oh, well, I wanted this game to end before they could cast Gearhulk, but I guess we're continuing and I'm going to lose.
Oh, that was the other issue I had with Leyline. I started out with having Leylines, like, in my sideboard, like, as part of a plan for this matchup, but when the first time I just got Divided by Zero and I got Opus'd the very next round, I'm like, yeah, this is not really ideal.
Yeah. I had not really thought about the implications of Divide by Zero on Leylines versus Hearses.
Well, it works out better to play Hearse, I think, because it's just more nimble of a card. And eventually it, like, clocks them for, like, 8 damage once, and that's generally good enough. Whereas if you, like, Leyline them, all it does is it drags the game out. They don't discard their Opuses, they can wait. And then it sort of... Yeah, I think you basically are just down a card for most of the game is what actually happens.
That is, in fact, the effect of Leyline. Are there any other, like, top-tier decks you feel like discussing in Pioneer? Or is it kind of all pretty well-defined still?
Well, so a few of the decks that I have question marks about are... I guess you brought up the Atraxian Neoform deck. I'm just not sure if you can... Like, it feels like that deck is so close to being great, but something feels like it's missing from the deck.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the Soul Flayer builds when I was playing it, but those appear to have just, like, disappeared. Just, like, it's another way to actually perform a relevant game action. And that's kind of what's missing is, like, the playing the Tasigur is no longer good enough. Sure. It's good, but it's not enough.
And the other question I had was, I'm not sure if you saw these, like, Fierce Empath, Ancient Imperious Sword, Torch Courier decks. I don't know if they're good enough, but there's something intriguing about those decks to me, with, like, Reckless Stormseeker, 8 Mana Dorks, Burning Tree Emissary, or I guess even, like, the Dwinen's Elite, Shaman of the Pack hybrid version I saw from Sleznil.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of that, but, like, the fact that... I guess my question is, like, when you talk about building it, like, there's this tension of, like, having other good cards in your deck and just, like, being able to make Imperious Sword function.
Yeah, that's why I suspect that the Gruul, like, haste up the guy version is not actually great, because I think your backup plan is not very good, because you basically only have one big guy in the deck. Whereas, like, the Elf version, like, you have four Shaman of the Pack, you have, like, the other, like, Elfy stuff. You just happen to have four Imperious Swords top end, which... maybe it makes more sense. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I mean, the Elves deck in this format was generally interesting to me a few months ago. So trying another, like, big endgame card that is not just, like, I have generated two of the top six creatures in my deck is sort of interesting.
Yeah, there's even one cheeky Turn Timber Symbiosis in the deck. Because I guess if you Symbiosis the Imperious Sword, that's, like, actually okay. But, well, actually... it's not even that big. It's only 6/6.
No.
Yeah, never mind. Yeah, I want.
Well, I mean, you can hit the empath with it, and then have a 4/4 and Imperial Sword.
Elf version doesn't even have an empath. I feel like you should have one. I don't know.
Potentially.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that's most of the thoughts I have on. Oh, Rona? Any Ronars in chat?
I remain skeptical of that deck. No one has figured out. I mean, this goes back to, like, the Modern Breach deck, where, like, the Rona deck is trying to approximate that, but, like, the Modern Breach deck is just, here's a station and a Breach and, like, a Mox Amber, and you don't have to put any other bad cards in your deck, and your deck is just all, like, Roggevons and Ledger Shredders and Urza Sagas, and there's no Roggevons, Ledger Shredders, or Urza Sagas in this deck.
So
I'm saying.
Yeah. I know Matnass actually played Jeskai Ascendancy Rona in an RCQ in Denver last weekend. I think he lost in top 8, but I don't know the exact details of his deck or how it exactly was built.
Okay, we just talked about this.
It's Matt Nass
playing a combo deck. Like, this is, again, the kind of thing where it's like, you should look at the deck, but you shouldn't read too far into the single result out of that.
I did want to look at the deck list, but I couldn't find it anywhere. So, you know, good beats.
It wasn't tweeted out. In the year 2023, it was not just tweeted out there?
Apparently not.
Wow, that's disappointing. I do want to highlight one deck that I kind of saw pop up in the results that kind of intrigued me, which is a 4-color auras list. It's listed as, but, like, you know, it's the pretty traditional, like, there are searchable Light Paws auras, but there is another Hexproof creature in the format that is significantly more castable than Basra Tower Archers.
Yeah, I actually lost to this deck playing the Is It Gear Hulk deck. Because it seemed impossible to beat any of their Hexproof creatures, and they now have 8. It is Cybo Cryptomancer from the new set from Booster Draft, you might remember. But it sure does have Hexproof and Backup 1.
Yeah, well, the problem is that you forget that the actual creature has Hexproof, because the core conceit of the card is that it's a Starlit Mantle in Draft. But it is also just a 2-mana 1/2 Hexproof creature, which is good enough when you just want, like, you know, Slippery Bogle is a 1-mana 1/1 Hexproof creature. Like, you would play that if you could, but, you know, you can't. So this is the next best thing.
Yeah, I mean, and the deck I was trying when I got paired into this deck, I could not fathom ever beating a Hexproof creature. Now that they have, like, 7 to 8 of that sort of card instead of just 4, like, Reed literally had the same problem in the finals of the PT, except there were only 4 Glade Cover Scouts instead of, like, 8. Which is a significant difference, you know?
Yeah, there's a Gigantha in the list I'm looking at. I'm kind of skeptical of it at the point where, like, you have enough Hexproof creatures. Like, I don't really foresee ever wishing for a Gigantha in a winnable game. But I sort of underestimate that card a little bit, but I'm very skeptical in this 20 land deck that it's coming up.
Well, maybe the sideboard is just not very good, so it's just better to play a Gigantha as well. Who can say?
That might be true. I mean, there's a lot of 3s. You could play a 4th Damping Sphere. That's probably good enough value.
I don't. I'll let the Bogles enthusiasts figure that one out.
Yeah. So I think that about wraps it up for Pioneer. Let's do a quick limited check-in and kind of discuss the side of that for the people who are actually going to be showing up to any limited RCQs. Mm-hmm. So this format's pretty good, I think.
I'm going to maybe push back on the actual sealed deck, because I think there's just a lot of variation in, like, how many rares you can open and how many dual lands you can open. So for those of you who don't know...
Wait, there's not dual lands in the set, though.
Or, I mean, like, gain lands, you know?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which are dual lands for the purposes of limited, you know?
This is not the typical, I have opened 5 temples in my sealed deck in Theros Limited or whatever, where you just don't have rares. You actually want the gain lands to cast all the broken stuff.
So the thing is, like, in a normal booster pack, you're 50% to open a basic or a gain land. And I find that kind of unpleasant for sealed. For draft, I think it's fine. It's like, whatever, you know, you can collate that however you want. But the thing is, like, there's so many, like, multicolored pip rares because of the multiverse slot and, like, the just team up creatures that I find it kind of bothersome. Like, you could just have, like, 9 plus rares and only be able to play, like, 3 of them. Maybe that's a good thing in the end. I don't know. It does seem to me that the more mana fixing you open, the better off you are in the sealed deck portion, though.
Yeah, that's probably very true. I don't have a ton of thoughts on sealed of this format. I do like that the double rare slot, like the dual land part may be an issue, but the double rare slot definitely balances that out, because you're saying, oh, you only get to play three rares. Like, I think that in general, being able to open two, I think you can open three rares in packs of this format, but like,
yeah,
the fact that you are not just like, there's a known issue in some old seal formats like Shadows where you could just, you have one bonus slot that's uncommon or rare, and you just have these pools that are like, someone has 10 rares, someone has six rares. It just, like, that matchup just doesn't work out. And I think this format, like, the layering of it, and Strixhaven has some similarities where, like, you could open rare. You had the lesson slot where you could get a rare. You had the spellbook slot and the normal slot. And, like, it just balanced out, and every pool was relatively similar power level, with like a lot of the filler really mattering. But at the same time, I think this format is a little excessive on rares, and like that part may be the more like, oh, you're just gonna play against a bunch of Sunfalls, and that might not be the most fun experience.
Yeah, I mean, I will be personally playing sealed deck on Friday and Saturday. Like, for those of you who don't know, there are two literal PTQs with a very interesting format. It's seven rounds of sealed deck in Swiss, and it's a cut to top 32, and they just run four drafts. And I assume it's bracketed, but I'm not completely sure.
This is at the Pro Tour, right? They have actual Pro Tour qualifiers if you are at the Pro Tour convention.
So once you make the top 32, if you do three or your draft, you get an invite to the next Pro Tour, which I think this sort of mimics the old, like, sealed into draft on day two Grand Prix experience while not having to take up 2 days or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I think that's nice. It also reminds me of, like, there used to be actual PTQs at the Pro Tour back in the day, and those used to be these giant, you know, 500-person events where, you know, someone you knew would invariably lose in the finals and get, like, two booster boxes and just be the most upset person in the room.
That was invariably me winning two of those at Pro Tours.
Oh, yeah, you did win one of those at Pro Tour Paris?
And Pro Tour Philadelphia 2011, the OG modern Pro Tour.
Okay, well, I stand corrected. Everyone except Jarvis lost at those.
Yeah, well, there was a funny story about the Paris one. There was, like, some big cash four-set. There was some big cash tournament starting at the same time. So I think that PTQ was smaller than it normally would have been.
Oh, the PTQ? Like,
yeah. It was just literally the same start time. So I guess a bunch of people just decided to play for like 5,000 euros or whatever it was, you know?
That's fair. I guess regarding sealed deck of this format, just like really try to put your best cards in your deck is the advice I can give, because the best, let's transition to draft, because that's the part that's really going to determine the invite, it feels like. But the best cards in this format are messed up.
yeah. So what I'm going to do is look at 17 lands real quick. Filtered on traditional, not on the other one, because I don't think that actually tells you that much.
Well, my general opinion has been like the rares in this set are just like so 17 lands, if you look at the data, I think this is just a good point to talk about, like, limited data in general. Looking at limited data is often bad if the set is defined by synergies, because it is often hard to determine, like, a card has a functional range when it's a synergy format, and you could be towards the top or bottom of that range depending. I do not think this is also just a general thing where, like, the more individually powerful the cards in a set are, the less synergy really matters. And this set is just, like, all the way, like, off to the freaking side on power level versus synergy. Like, this is not War of the Spark, where there's even, like, proliferate synergies. Like, no. We're just, the cards are just good. And, like, I don't know. This, me drafting this format, I've been relatively successful, like, you know, pretty standard to, like, how I've done on, you know, various formats of drafting. But, like, I honestly just, like, look at the 17 lands data, and 99% of the time, I just say, oh, this card was, you know, I come down to, like, these are the three cards. This one is the best on data. I'm taking it. And that has just felt largely good. Just because, again, the most powerful cards are very obviously good. And, like, any of the subtlety is just lost in the fact of, like, it's not even just the rares. Like, the top, like, I don't know. How good do you think, if you were to rank all the commons, the green black, the 3-mana 3/3 elf that makes an incubate 2 and can like flip things is? Okay, maybe I lied. That is currently the second ranked uncommon. But my point is like, okay. Sure. It's like, I don't know. It's like the 10th and best of one. But like, if you just go down the list of the best uncommons in the format, like, you get to about like the 15th best one, and that card is still like a game dominating card. And I am like, it is very difficult to consider like, how good do your synergies have to be better than Streetwise Negotiator, which is just a 2-mana 3/3 with upside. Like, I don't understand what you're trying to build that is better than that. And that is literally like the 15th best on common.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of issues with the power. Like, the power is so compressed in the like rares, uncommons, and mythics, I would say. Like, the commons are pretty pushed too, but the difference with Phyrexia Albion one, where like basically all the commons were juiced, that was a format where you tried to kill your opponent. And in this format, I think you can get into a lot of board stalls, which means the like more clunky, more powerful cards have time to come online. Mostly because battles do imply that people start at a higher life total and that people try to contest them instead of like dealing their opponent's damage, you know?
I don't know if I 100% agree with that. This format is different. Like, Phyrexia Ulvi one, like, you are actually trying to kill your opponent and your opponent goes to zero life. In this format, at some point, you look at the board and you're like, oh, that player won the game. Like, it's very much like the actual dealing of the 20 damage is sort of a formality. I don't have too many deep thoughts about the format beyond just like take the cards that are winning a lot. I do have one, which is that because the best cards are so darn good, the best thing you are supposed to do in a lot of draft situations is you are either supposed to exit pack one with good cards with the intent of putting them in your deck, or exit the pack with like the ability to just take a good card and drop a color at will. That's just kind of like, it's a format that really rewards you for, I don't want to say staying open without committing, but being able to just pick something and like, if you open a Sunfall, you pack two, like you should either have already had cards that are about the same par or like be able to take it. Like there's no excuse to be in a spot where that isn't the case.
So would a better way of putting it be that you think decks in this format need a minimum power level to even compete?
I don't know what define a minimum power level.
Like having one of the better uncommons in your deck, or having like some busto rare, or I don't know, basically just having some really premium cards in your deck.
If you did not end the draft with those, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, because basically the conceit is these packs have so many like rares or uncommons or whatever in them. You should be able to find one at some point, right?
Yeah, like if you ended up with no broken cards in your deck, that means that you like accidentally found yourself drafting an archetype instead of good cards, and then like forced your way into an archetype instead of just taking the good cards. Like that's just the opposite of what you should do. Mm-hmm. I did enjoy, I was like sort of, I had a draft where I had Zephyr Singer, I think is the name. The 2-blue-blue Convoke Flying Vigilance that gives everything you convoke it with flying. And I'm like, this card is absolutely absurd. You just cast it on turn 3 so many games. I want to know if, like, this has to be, like, the winningest game in hand. Like, if you open it, have it in your opening 7, this has to be the winningest card in the format or whatever.
That's not even true, right?
Well, I want you to take a guess where it stands.
Well, are we filtered for traditional or BO1?
Best, it doesn't really matter. Don't look, just guess.
Well, the problem is I actually looked like earlier today. I believe the answer is Elishmorn.
No, that's the best overall. But in your opening hand, Zephyr Singer is actually pretty close. But in best of one, the answer should be very obvious. It's just Roggewon. Just in your opening hand is the best part.
Okay.
Sure. I was really amused. It's one of those, like, you know, I don't know what I expected, just like in the flesh moment. Okay. I really, really enjoyed that. Even though Raghavan doesn't have like as high of like an overall, you know, percentage here. Like, it's just like, oh yeah, if it's in your opening hand, you win the game. Yeah, I also think that the other thing that's kind of telling about this format is like how good removal is, just because the good cards are so good. So killing your opponent's good card is also so good. Like Deadly Derision, which is the 4-mana instant speed kill spell, is like the second best common in the format, or maybe third. It's hard to tell, like, whether you call the Afara's Dispersal, the bounce spell, a better card.
Is Afara's Dispersal better than Praying Champion?
No, that is the best card.
Okay.
Like, Praying Champion is just like the best common, not even close. Don't worry about it.
Sure.
But once you get past that point.
Sure. I would believe it's close, but I would probably lean towards Derision.
Yeah, and I also want to note that the counterspell is like the fifth best common. The Assimilate Essence. That card is that good.
Well, the reason is the good cards are so good that countering them is also that good.
Yeah, and it's just like the best 2-drop is just like a 2-drop that could trade for a bomb rare.
Yeah. I don't know. Something I feel like about this format is with all the really powerful cards and having to draft a powerful deck, it sort of feels like Cube in a weird sort of way. I mean, obviously the analogy is not exactly perfect, but the fact that there's so many powerful cards and that you really just want to draft them and maybe mana fixers, it feels like old era Cube, maybe.
Or some, I think vintage Cube, ignoring the mono white and mono red decks, feels a lot like that as well.
Well, I guess you're just ignoring all of the combo decks that happen in vintage Cube as well.
I find those largely are covered by you have opened a specific powerful combo card.
Okay, sure.
Like, you aren't going to, I think maybe it's not the perfect example, but like, Lotus, obviously, but like Time Spiral or whatever. Like, you have access to Time Spiral or Talarian Academy, and that is what is leading you down this road.
Sure.
Yeah, the one thing I would caution is that, like, you should, if you are going to think you are ending up drafting this format for stakes, actually look at the numbers on some of the rares, just because, like, there are, or on commons as well, like, there are a lot of cards that are unexpectedly not better, but a lot worse than you think, I think. I think a prime example would be Invasion of Kamigawa, which is the, like, battle that ETB taps a thing and then turns into this like 2-3 flying that draws cards on damage. It's, I think it's literally was one of the worst uncommons. Yeah, so it's currently the fourth worst uncommon. It's just unplayable.
I think that might be a stretch, but I think one thing you have to realize is there are multiple types of blue decks. If you're like Azorius Knights, I think that card is still probably pretty good. But if you're just,
I don't,
like,
think it is. It's just so low impact on the front side that, like, you can't afford it in any game where you are not winning. I just think that, like, you, again, this, there are enough gotchas that it's worth looking to make sure that you actually know what the good cards are or aren't.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the rares are that good. Some of them aren't. Like, I'm not thrilled to first pick, like, Coughlin Yodaro. I think that one's, like, a little bit.
Oh, no. I think that card's busted.
Well, I'm not thrilled about first picking it because it's such a huge commit. If it was like 5 red-green, I would be a lot more excited, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I also at the same time think that Blighted Burgeoning is just a good enough card that you should be able to make it work.
Well, one note about Blighted Burgeoning is Fertile Ground, not Gift of Paradise.
Yes, it is only one fixing pip, but you can make the rest of it work, I think.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is, like, just when you open your pack, you look at the rare, just think long and hard about if it's good enough or how committal it is, I guess, is another way of putting it. I guess if you're willing to first pick that Gruul card, that maybe you should just take a lot of those. Like, how do you feel about Galta?
Great. Probably a little worse, but, like, also great.
Yeah, and there is, like, a consensus that blue black's the best deck, but I kind of feel like most decks work in the format, like, despite color power rankings.
Well, you see, if you got rares, it all works.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't matter. It just happens that, so the reason blue black is the best deck is, one, the best, like, five blue commons are all bananas, and then like the good black commons are good enough, but also the blue and black uncommons are just like almost rare. Well, like Halo Forge and Invasion of Amonkhet, just almost
rare. So y'all probably don't remember, but Invasion of Amonkhet is just disinformation campaign staple backside body double, which is kind of an obscene card.
Yeah, it's just not even remotely reasonable. Rather than talk about like a lot of the specifics of the format, sure. I think other podcasts have really covered a lot more in detail than our mm-hmm. not really limited format discussion. I think that it might be worth discussing like any play patterns we found that are relatively common, or like things about actually playing the format that are sort of interesting or unique. And I think that one of the big things is that like, you, like I said, life totals don't matter quite as much. So like, I think that there is, you should be when it comes down to like, am I making a good attack? You should be a little more conservative about like trading off resources for actual damage until the mm-hmm. point where it is actually going to win sure. the game, because yep. there's not a lot of like clean closeouts. And also just like that comes down to a lot of other stuff about like spending removal or tricks. Like you have to be generating like a very significant advantage to use removal or a trick on something that isn't a bomb rare, or like have no other viable plays where it's just like, this is a good enough way to spend my mana and I have another piece of removal back or whatever.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. Also, like one really annoying thing about tricks in this format is if you play against a white deck, they just have creatures on tap. It's kind of hard to play around cut short in a lot of scenarios. Like, it's almost impossible, I would say, if the game has gone any length of time.
I mean, I think the same applies for Aerial Maneuver, I think, is the name. What's the name of the two mana convoke?
Aerial Shot? No. Doesn't
yeah, it's just the it's a Mighty Leap with Convoke. Aerial Boost.
Okay, Aerial Boost, yeah. It's yeah. just so hard to play around instant speed Convoke cards. Especially if your opponent's sitting back, because obviously their creatures are untapped, then it's pretty easy for them to like do that and maybe do something else the same turn, which is going to completely mess you up. So think about that too. I think that's like specifically an issue with there being so many instant speed convoke cards in this format.
Yeah, I think that is a good point to emphasize, because when people say convoke is broken, I think most of that is just the instant speed ones. Sorcery stuff is like fine, like maybe you get to cast your spell cheaper, but the instant speed ones are like your creatures are doing the full function of a creature. They're just there messing up combat for your opponent's turn, and then you just cast a spell. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, I really think they might have missed the mark on this one, because I remember when Convoke first came out, it was in Celestia and original Ravnica. There were a few instant speed Convoke cards, but it was like Devouring Light instead of Cut Short, which is like very, very different. And like it would scatter
the seed. Similar to me, I guess. I think Gather Courage, wasn't that card moved up to an uncommon in a set after the original Ravnica?
Well, yeah, the other issue with the original Ravnica was every creature was terrible, so like that didn't really matter.
That's fair. Yeah, instant speed Convoke is very good. That's basically the gist of that.
The one thing I want to emphasize is I think one thing I've seen a lot of people do that kind of hurts them is to play like a bunch of like mediocre early creatures that don't really have enough impact, which causes you to flood on like lands and slash war cards that don't do anything in the late game, simply because like it's hard to compete if your cards don't do enough, even with like a rare or something, if you just don't have enough cards that do things, is how I would put it. Like if you feel you're with a bunch of 2/2s that don't scale into the late game in some regard, it's going to be difficult once you draw them on like turn 7 or 8.
Yes, I entirely agree with that. And the good 2-drops are the ones that are like doing a little bit more, like the 1 green 3/1 that surveils on ETB and death.
Oh yeah. That card's excellent. It's kind of wild to me that some people don't like that card, because I just look at it and I'm like, isn't this card just, you're going to trade with something meaningful if you want to, and it gives you a bunch of selection, you know?
Yeah. Yes, I agree with all that. I guess turning back towards constructed formats, the other half of this Pro Tour coming up, to slightly touch on it, is going to be standard. Do you have any predictions on the standard format based on the early results? Like, is Atali as good as it has looked on Magic Online, or are we waiting to see what other cards people can pull out of the set?
I do believe Atali is that good. And I'm struggling to see, like, what can stop these Atali wars, really. I mean, I guess, like, Make Disappear maybe is the good guy again? Question mark?
Yeah, I think that if you can expect a turn back from people were leaning into Rakdos. I think with Atali, so Atali has been showing up in the mono white deck, has just been splashing Fable and Atali. Yep. This is the 7-mana Atali that just, like, cascades both players' decks and is a 7/7 and, like, just this giant value ball that also just kills your opponent. The white decks actually can finish the game now, but the Rakdos decks turning back towards Grixis for that stack interaction does matter a lot as people move towards casting 7 drops.
Yeah, I think I agree there. Maybe a hidden gem in the rough is, do you remember the, like, Matt Nass, Andrew Beckstrom, like, not all-in Rakdos Reanimator deck?
Yeah, and I'm just looking at the latest standard challenge, and there is basically one of those sort of in the top eight with, like, Fable, Elder Dragon War, Cruelty of Grix, and just, like, Atali is the even more castable version of Atraxa.
Yeah, they have 3 Atali. This is, if I were playing this Pro Tour, I would probably have ended up on something close to this without a testing team. You know, like, this looks very appealing to me because it does something kind of very strong, but it doesn't. You don't have to submit so many Uno cards in your deck, is the best way of putting it. Like, you have 1 Uno card instead of 4.
Do you even need the Atraxa that's in this deck?
I think you probably do, but it's kind of close by this point. Like, I guess, like, drawing 2 cards and casting them both for free is almost as good as drawing, like, 5 cards, right?
Yeah, depending on the spot, but yeah, I generally agree with that. Especially if none of your cards are counterspells of any kind, then yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like, this deck is very appealing to me. I wouldn't be surprised if someone is playing that deck and ended up well with it. I mean, it's like, Make Disappear is certainly good versus this deck, but it can also, like, just make other plays on turns. It doesn't have to cast the most expensive card on every turn cycle, you know?
Yeah, I would say that Make Disappear, like, it's not just, like, it's the negates and the disdainful strokes and, like, whatever of it, and you can figure that out there. Like, the Grixis deck, if this is exactly what it expects, can load up on enough counterspells to make a huge difference here, because if you actually look at it, like, one of the issues in the Grixis mirror is that, like, it's not just Blood Tithe Harvester, it's, like, this combo of, like, Harvester and Bankbuster and Fable and Corpse Appraiser that is applying pressure so that you can't just rawly fight counter wars over the Invoke Despairs every single time. This deck, it's pretty light on the early stuff. It's just got Fables and Harvesters, and, like, I think you can expose yourself to those a little more with an overload on counter magic if it means the end game is resolved.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. One thing I'm sort of excited to see is, I wonder if there will be, like, a bunch of Chandra Invoke Despair decks, like Rakdos or Grixis style. Kind of excited to see that happen, because that's a lot. Though, like, that's bordering on actual cruel ultimatum by that point.
I'm skeptical, because as soon as you start talking about having Chandra in your deck and Invoke Despair being a good card, that means your Chandra will get Invoke Despair.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe it's just a pipe dream, but, you know, it could happen. Like, if you play, like, Rakdos versus, like, white, that could definitely happen.
Yes, but how good do you think the white deck is, or, like, how much do you think Atali is just going to change that?
That is unclear to me. I'm looking at the last challenge. It looks like white was mostly hated out. There's one person, but it's... No, it is the Boros deck. It's just labeled as mono white for some reason.
Because it's a mono white deck. It just has red cards.
I guess the other thing I didn't consider is, how good do you think Surge of Salvation is versus black-red style decks?
Probably worse than you think it is. I think that, especially out of... The problem is that you'd have to build a white deck where your opponent doesn't just want to rise against you. And I don't think the mono white deck achieves that kind of setup.
Oh, sure. And I guess if you're just burning Surge on Duress, that isn't really that exciting as well.
They were just going to Duress your Surge if they cared about it.
Sure.
It's not Veil of Summer.
I guess the question I have for you is, how much of this Pro Tour do you think, like, what percentage of people do you think are registering Blood Tithe Harvester, Fable, Sulphur Springs?
I would say, I don't think it's quite like the 60-some percent of the Oko days, but probably closer to like a classical 40% where like it's the best deck and known the best deck. But I guess maybe that covers multiple decks, so it might be like 45. Maybe a bit more.
That's a large number. But the issue I have is I find it really hard to believe that it's not correct to register Blood Tithe Harvester, Fable with Mirror Breaker, Sulphur Springs.
Well, you just described like four different decks. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. That show isn't actually that like large, so you can add another color. You could like add green if you wanted to for some reason, if you thought that was a good idea. Not that I think it's a good idea, but you know, I guess you could technically be Mardu as well, but that's like a harder sell without the Triome.
I mean this relates to something about the standard format where I've generally felt like you want to build a deck that looks like it wants a Triome and then try to build it without the Triome because tap lands suck and just like untap lands are good. The bigger issue is that the Mardu deck does not have access to Darkslick Shores or the equivalent.
Yeah, it only has Blackleaf Cliffs because the overlap is not quite right.
Yeah, also I don't know what white card I would want to splash.
Well, you see, the early versions of those decks had like Mondrak and Wedding Announcement.
I do recall a little bit of this, but like I don't know. I don't think Wedding Announcement is the scale I want to be fighting with my Blood Tithe Harvesters. Like it feels like the card that you put in your deck because you're making a concession to the fact that you only have so many of the cards that are similar to the Grixis stuff to put in your deck.
Yeah. I guess other question is poison, toxic, question mark?
Max McVitie's qualified for this Pro Tour. You can look at one player, right?
I mean, God, if that deck is bad, he'll have such a bad time. Okay, Max's last posting was Mono Red Aggro 4-3. Oh, right. This was the 12-card sideboard he submitted in a challenge by accident and won 4-3.
Yeah, I mean, do you have faith in the Red Aggro deck at all?
No.
Okay.
It got a bunch of good cards, but I don't think that solves the primary issue with it, which is the lack of quality one drops.
I mean, Kamado Faces Kakazan is very good, but yes, the next best one drop is not very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the deck is... I mean, I guess we could touch on how Kenra Spellspear is also just kind of a messed up card.
Oh, yeah, that one's... If you've ever triggered that one in draft, your opponent always dies. It's like kind of it's kind of unreasonable, actually.
Yeah, it turns out the second Instant of Prowess scales like exponentially and not linearly because...
Please don't. It literally scales linearly. Please don't do that shit. Literally 2n plus 3.
Jarvis, I thought you were here to just put an end to the math talk, but no, you're here to escalate it.
I was here to prevent the blatant misuse of the word exponential, just like B. White's would do.
Well, he's not around, so I thought I could get away with it.
Well, you thought wrong.
Anyway, I guess I did.
I mean, Kenra's Spellspear does show up in these decks. I don't think it's too costly to pay the... Like, I guess if you get cut down in response, it's pretty terrible. But you can usually play around that by having like a Play with Fire or something on that turn cycle.
Yeah. There's some balance there, but a lot of it comes down to the fact that if you aren't actually ahead on board on turn one because your deck has to play freaking Phoenix Chick, it's a lot harder to make those kinds of positioning decisions.
Yeah, it kind of feels like the two-drop Phoenix is so much better than the one-drop Phoenix in the stack.
Do you like the two-drop Phoenix?
I think I'm a skeptic on that card. Well, I think I would put it in my deck and try it at least.
Okay, yeah, the idea of ever having to cast that as a normal Magic card does not excite me.
Max also had Invasion of Urgatha. That doesn't seem great. That's basically flame rift. Yeah, but is this really a format where you can flame rift your opponent to death?
Jarvis, I will accept any form of Flames of the Blood Hand. It is fine. I have not grown out of that phase.
It's been like 19 or 18.
I understand, Jarvis. I said what I said.
It's been a long time since Flames of the Blood Hand was legal and standard. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. Dealing 4 to your opponent is good, though. I mean, Stoke the Flames, also legal. Neither of those kill children, but also legal.
Yeah, that's an issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Nahiri's Warcrafting exists, right?
Yeah, they used to play Rebel Salvo, but obviously I think Nahiri's Warcrafting is just much better.
Yeah, I mean, the card that might kill something else and draw a card is better than the card that doesn't do that.
Yep.
Yeah. I guess, while we speculate on Standard, neither of us has a ton to go off of, and we'll see deck lists relatively soon, and Dom will be back next week to talk about that. Maybe it's time to turn our eye back from Pro Tour formats, RCQ formats, back to good old Modern, the kind of, you know, longtime bedrock of the show. And it feels like this weekend's results, as we bridge into those, have been a bit more of the same, but a lot of the stuff that had started to pop up last week is really solidified. So this feels like, I don't want to say a breakout weekend because we saw this before, but the creativity list that is Jund, but with Renin Realmbreaker is now like really having good results. And it feels like this is getting to the point where the old Jund creativity list had to play a lot of bad cards, and it often had to play like, I mean, Liliana of the Veil is a fine card, but like pretty narrow. And this list getting to play with Invasion of Ergamon and Renin Realmbreaker feels like it's a step forward in the right direction.
Definitely agree with you. When I saw the changes that had been made to the deck, specifically the Renin Realmbreaker stood out to me because I think having a hexproof thing for that is really valuable. And also a cheap treasure maker on turn two that also lets you loot is pretty strong, I think.
Yeah, Invasion of Ergamon is the red-green invasion. It's, you know, red-green ETB, make a treasure, and then you can rummage a card away. Then there's some nonsense about turning into like a 3/4 that lets you tutor for a battle or whatever, but I don't imagine that happens a lot.
I mean, in this deck, I think the only other card you can tutor for is another red-green.
You can get any land.
Oh, right. You can do that. So I guess you could get a Dwarven Mine if you wanted to. But you could also You could get another Invasion of Ergamon.
Well, so the first time I actually played against this card, my opponent was able to find like a Valakut and was playing with Dryads and Titans and stuff.
That's kind of cute.
Yeah, I'm not huge on that, but I'm just saying it's a thing that could happen. But I think it's just really like Renin Realmbreaker as like does a lot of things. The mana fixing is obviously less relevant when you are, you know, Jund instead of all the other colors, but that's not the worst thing to have. You know, that's the static of your lands can produce any color. And it kind of like milling cards to like provide some of that Renin 6 type of equity where like it is both capable of putting an Archon in your graveyard for persist, but also like building you up and putting lands from your graveyard into your hand to cast or like finding a fable. And I think this got discussed last week, but like the ultimate is very, very absurd.
Yeah, did you know if you minus 7 it, you can just immediately recast the same Renin Realmbreaker?
That's what I said. I didn't know that till the first time it happened in draft, and then I was like, oh wow, okay.
Yeah, but yeah. In this deck, I think what might happen is sometimes people try to exhaust your Archons by tanking all of them. With Renin Realmbreaker, I think that's a lot less likely unless if literally all of your Archons got solituded somehow.
Yeah, that is totally fair. You also had a little bit of that with like Renin 6 flashing back persist infinite times, but yes. Sure. Oh, sorry, retracing. Moving on from that deck, a new Xenowon friend of the show, Glimpseless, dropped featuring Invasion of Alara. And my understanding is that it is easy to forget that you have Invasion of Alara triggers on the stack when you are playing this list.
How does that happen? Like,
so you see, Invasion of Alara is an ETB ability of a card that you are flipping off of Glimpse of Tomorrow.
Oh, God. Why is this card sideways?
Jarvis, it's been a month. You should be used to this by now.
Okay. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, God. Oh, oh my God, why does this do this?
It cascades twice. That's basically it.
Well, but it might hit a cascader, which causes you to cascade again.
Yeah, but the end result is that you are always casting a glimpse. I mean, this is just like the most powerful like alternative to, you know, whatever like Goblin Dark Dweller style effect you would be playing.
Also, if you ever flip that card, your opponent dies, but that's neither here nor there.
I honestly don't know what the backside is, and I don't want to. Fury can't deal damage to it, so that's fine.
Do you remember Last Stand?
It's not quite that, but yes.
I know, but it's kind of a funny throwback to it in a lot of ways. It's actually a throwback to, like... Okay, draw two cards is like Esper Charm. Put an artifact from your hand onto the battlefield is like Master Transmuter. I don't know. There's probably some like combination of Alara block cards you could say this is representing.
I honestly couldn't tell you. I think the token that's a copy is like an offshoot of the Bant Ultimatum that let you tutor up copies of existing cards.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a lot. I will say if you flip that side somehow, which I don't think would really happen in this deck, because I actually expect your opponent to die before that happens, if I had to guess most of the time, it does give you a lot of stuff.
I am kind of interesting. Like, this is a Cascade deck that is cut down to two Shardless Agent because it's too busy doing other Cascade things.
Well, you see, once you have five colors in your deck, you can do whatever the hell you want.
Sure.
Like, such as put Elishnorn into your deck, which also, like, results in ridiculous board states.
Yeah, I mean, you just, like...
Yeah,
a lot of things occur.
I kind of wonder if this causes your MTGO to crash more often than other, like, things.
That is a problem that I assume was considered after the fact of the first time you go through it and see what happens.
Well, Xenowon never ended up playing the Battle of Wits version because... I believe...
You could not click submit in an event with it? Yes.
Apparently, you weren't even allowed to play it, which is kind of funny.
That's sad. I guess moving to another development related to March of the Machine, how much does Ozolith the Shattered Spire actually improve Hardened Scales? My opinion has actually been a lot.
Interesting. Let me see if I find any scales. All right, none in that one.
So it has shown up, and basically Ozolith, the Shattered Spire, is like 2 to 3 of, and it's nice to have another Hardened Scales because obviously the math goes big, but the thing that really impressed me, and it's like a really, really simple interaction, is just that, like, if you have the Ozolith and you have an Inkmoth Nexus, your opponent dies really fast.
Yeah, the Ozolith is very impressive, just, like, generally speaking.
Well, like, Ozolith Hardened Scales Nexus is just a two-turn clock, right? You just do 4 and then 7, and then your opponent's done.
Yeah, and also, like, Ozolith plus Ozolith is also a lot. Like, you can't really, like, get rid of all of the counters very easily. It's just great. Yeah, it's ridiculous. Also, did you know you can activate Ozolith onto the Ozolith?
Yeah, I think this is one of the things where, like, you've approached the point of Hardened Scales where if you ever have to do the math is lethal. Like, that is by far, like, yeah, that's way more than I ever want to do math on.
Why does this deck have a Power Depot in it now?
It is another instance of, like, an artifact land that has graph, right?
Tapped. It's tapped.
I mean, the other graph land is tapped.
Yeah, but I don't want to put that one in my deck either. Can I just play 0 of those?
But what if you want to sack Power Depot to Arcbound Ravager?
I guess. I don't know.
It's not like this deck has a lot of cards that cost 1 mana. And also, like, there's a decent amount of value to not just casting Hardened Scales on turn 1 in a lot of matchups.
You know what? One of these people in the Modern Challenge cut all the Arcbound workers, which I don't know how I feel about that.
Are there Zabazas though?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. The actual workers are kind of filler or whatever.
Okay, sure. How do you feel about Patchwork Automaton?
Great. I think that's one of the most important cards in the deck.
What if I told you one of the people cut down to 3?
I understand that they're not good in multiples, but I'm not offended by that. I think that the problem is that, like, if the number is ever between 0 and 2, I think that's wrong. But I think that Patchwork is just like the thing that you are casting that doesn't die to really like the big lineup is like you cannot prismatic ending a Patchwork automaton in any reasonable time frame.
Fair enough. By the way, there's another card that I just noticed, but it's from technically Phyrexia All Will Be One. It's Soulless Jailer in these Hardened Scales decks. And I don't think I've ever seen that card anywhere else so far.
Yeah, I think it's good. I mean, if you just read the text of Cascade, it is good versus that. And like that seems like a totally fine thing to have in multiple spots. Like this is the deck that if you're going to do that, it's going to make sense to do. Especially because you're a Welding Jar deck. I think that is the turning point where, like, if you were not a Welding Jar deck, you would not necessarily want an artifact for that slot. And also, like, I don't know. I think it's good or, like, better than a Chalice would be just because of the flexibility. Like, it covers Cascade and, like, I don't know if anyone's trying to graveyard stuff, but...
Sure. Quick rules question. It says permanent cards and graveyards can't enter the battlefield. If there's an escape creature, they can still cast it, correct?
It enters the stack.
Okay, that's I wanted to clarify that for myself and maybe for the viewers at home.
Yeah. So it's very specifically like you cannot persist something. Sure. You cannot persist or it cannot trigger persist. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. In terms of new cards, that about does it for Modern. It has been a good couple weekends for Tron. I just wanted to point that out. I still don't understand how Tron wins in this day and age, but the format has been slowing down, which means that a lot of the actual pressures on the deck have alleviated a bit, where like a lot of the problems with Tron were just like assembling Tron on 4 or 5 just isn't good enough in so many spots, so like you just had to mulligan to these absurd hands, and like I don't think that really plays quite as well in the face of any kind of interaction. But like if your opponents are just playing decks that aren't really pressuring you that bad and those like turn 4, turn 5 assemblies are a big deal still, then yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, it's funny you bring this up because I heard like the exact same sentiment from both Ellen Bogan and your evil twin Azax. They're just like, every Tron deck doesn't look like it makes any sense, but it keeps winning.
Well, I mean, I understand why it is winning. Like, we've had a couple weeks of Modern where, like, Bring to Light has been good. And, like, these much slower decks than you expect are winning because the like, Hammer has had a decreased presence. So they're no longer getting crushed out of the metagame. Murktide has had a slightly decreased presence. So, like, the Raghavan and Duke Counterspell plays are less relevant. Just, like, a lot of these things that previously really pressured these kind of big mana decks have gone. And as a result, Tron is just the biggest of the big in that domain.
Well, do you think 4 Mystical Dispute Rhinos would be good versus Tron, like, generally speaking?
I don't think so. I think I'd rather be the main deck Blood Moon versions that previously existed. And, like okay, so let's rewind to the other cards that are in your deck. Like, Murktide Regent is not good versus Tron.
I agree.
Okay. So, like, Force Negation is still good, but, like, the rest of what's going on, not so much.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, Living End is scarier. Like, aside from the whole Relic of Regenerative stuff, like, I think that a deck that is capable of killing your opponent as opposed to just making 2/4/4s and then your opponent plays a freaking Wormcoil Engine, you're like, well, didn't expect that one to show up today.
The Cityscape Levelers from the Tron decks do look good, though. Like, that is one observation I will make.
Yeah, I mean, it is the mini version of Ulamog.
Yep, interesting way of putting it. Wait, did Shocktruva win a challenge with Lutron?
Okay, well, that brings us right into Nonsense of the Week, where the winner is the entire challenge that Shocktruva won. The entire thing. Everything about this. So, let's start at the top, where Mono Bluetron won a challenge. Like, it had a top 8, I think, in a PTQ, but this is just like...
Sure.
Let's just go quickly through what stock Mono Bluetron looks like these days, because this is the minimum amount of nonsense. So, it looks like the Shocktruva stock is... No Karn the Great Creator. A very classic 3/3/3/3 mix of the very stock Thirst, Condescend, Repeal, Remand. Mindslaver still showing up in this day and age with an Academy Runes. Multiple Gemstone Caverns, which feels like the only adoption of a 2023 thing. Main deck Chalice, good thing for this metagame with a slight uptick in Cascade. Sundering Titan, very good these days. Two Trinket Mages and a Treasure Mage because you never know what you want. There's a Shark Typhoon. Sadly, the Nimble Obstructionist has no longer shown up. Very sad to see that. But there is a Squelch in the sideboard in its honor.
I see. Yeah, for those of you who don't remember, I believe Shock Trooper has been playing Bootron for a literal 18 years since it was in Standard.
Yeah, if you just look up, you know, Shock Trooper on MTG Goldfish, I'm sure you can find results from, like, I don't know, how far back does their database go? So we're on page 10 of this database, and this is a 2012 Modern Challenge, and they are playing Bluetron with Bottle Gnomes and Platinum Angel and Ribbons of Night.
Well, you just listed a black card.
But their deck's otherwise blue.
Okay. Yeah. For curiosity's sake, I went to my last finish on Goldfish. It was January 4th, 2011. So I guess that's around when Goldfish started keeping track of this stuff.
We're starting to reach the point where it's possible that that was when Magic Online started reliably publishing deck lists to somewhere that has not disappeared off the internet.
Oh, yeah, there used to be another site called like MTG Stats, but it was really MTGO Stats in disguise. Because I remember it had like all of the like goofy formats like Tribal Wars deck lists as well as like Modern and, you know, Standard or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Anyways, turning back to the rest of this challenge that has shown up is the entirety of Nonsense of the Week. We also have our this might not even be the most ridiculous appearance of Amulet Titan this week. There's Mistaken, very well-known Amulet player, playing Atraxa Dramatic Entrance Amulet. So just Amulet Titan core with Dramatic Entrance, putting in Atraxa or Primeval Titan. Yeah, I'm just going to hit Dom with this one when he gets back because he has more of an opinion than we do. But, I mean, we went through the Amulet math recently where it's just like, oh, well, you need any ramp spell to turn double Amulet from 5 mana into 6. Well, you can just Dramatic Entrance, right? That's a way to turn 5 mana into 6.
Sure.
I mean, we also, this week, there was a deck in the top 8 of another challenge that was Amulet, or it was Titanless Amulet Titan, parentheses, Kahira, which was just the 4 Cultivator Colossus version of the deck.
Sure.
With Arboreal Grazer being a beast as well.
Sure. One interesting thing is, once you move to Dramatic Entrance, this person has smartly cut all of the Castle Garen rigs, because it doesn't really work very well.
I think that card just kind of disappeared with the appearance of Mycosynth Gardens. Well, so this doesn't have zero Mycosynth Gardens.
I was about to bring that up too, like, once you said that. There's zero of that. I think it's a nod to being able to try to hardcast Atraxa, if I had to guess, because you see...
But Mycosynth Garden can tap for any color of mana, Jarvis.
But at a bad rate. It's like Shimmering Grotto.
I think at the point that you're casting Atraxa, you know, six of one, half dozen of the other, your mana is going to be dicey, and I don't think you're going to hit it on exactly 7, but I could be wrong there. What I won't be wrong about is the fact that Slivers also top-aided this challenge.
I'm looking for the Slivers deck. I'm looking.
It has 4 squiggly A third vial.
Well, also, their username's Southern Sliver. I love that, actually. They know what they're
about. Again, back to our whole thing about when the person whose name is the deck they're playing top 8's a challenge, I wouldn't read too far into it.
Yeah, but it's funny.
It is funny. The thing that I like is that Surge of Salvation is split with Force of Negation in the main deck as a nod to, like, maybe ever defeating a Fury. But it is very sad to note that there's only a single 1-drop in this deck, and it's the same Gale Rider Slivers. You know, this deck could really use another 1-drop that's playable.
Also, there are 7 white sources for this Surge of Salvation.
Yeah, that's a slight problem.
Yeah, I mean, this is always like an issue in tribal decks, where like, yeah, your lands are rainbow, but they're only rainbow for your creatures, not for your spells.
Yeah, these Fiery Islets could be mana confluences if you were that concerned.
Or a Silent Clearings.
I don't really, like, look at the creatures and tell me what Silent Clearing casts besides these 4 Leeching Slivers.
Cindy Sliver?
Dragscape Sliver. Yeah, maybe that's close.
Cloud Trader Sliver? Predatory Sliver? Frenetic Sliver? Well, that's a lot of Fennec Silvers, but...
Yeah, flipping coins is fun and competitive. Okay, so this is not the end of the nonsense here, because we have, further down the standings, Bank Cascade Control. Straight out of the pre-modern days of deck design, we are casting Shardless Agent and flipping up Ancestral Vision to draw cards. And, you know, casting a bunch of free interaction that way.
Let me look for this deck.
This is in 17th place. It features 4 Solitude, 4 Shardless Agent, a Subtlety, 4 Force and Negation, 4 Temporal Lockdown.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a Jace the Mind Sculptor somehow.
You know what this reminds me of? A very old Legacy deck I played called Shardless Bant. It has a lot of like same overlap.
I mean, it is Shardless Bant. That is the deck we're looking at.
I think my deck had Thopter Sword in it, but it also had like Brainstorm and Ponder, which this But I also did have Ancestral Vision, so I don't know, you know, some good vibes.
Temporary Lockdown, pretty good. Overwhelming Denial, do you even know what that card does in the sideboard?
Is that a 2 blue-blue counter target spell that can't be countered? Has Surge 1 blue-blue?
Surge of blue-blue, thank you very much.
Oh, it's so close, though. Come on.
Yeah, how often does the text "you or a teammate" show up on a card you have registered in a constructed Magic format? Probably more for you.
I'm trying to remember.
I'd have to look up how many cards the word teammate show up on. There's also an Inevitable Betrayal in the sideboard. You can sideboard into instead of the Vision in matchups where stealing a creature from your opponent is better. That's kind of cute. Overall, I think there's some like solid, you know, in the midst of a lot of other things like Merfolk having some decent results here and across the rest of the weekend, Living End still having good results, like stuff you would expect. A lot of good nonsense in this challenge that everyone should take a look at.
Yeah, sounds great.
And one other shout out to Kuldotha Red 2023 in the Nonsense of the Week segment. This is just, you know, 8 Kuldotha Rebirths in the form of Gleeful Demolition and Goblin Grenade showing up and just like, I don't know, name the cards that were in Kuldotha Red. You have 8 Bushwhackers and 8 Kuldotha Rebirths and the fastest haste goblins in the world. But also, I think the thing that drew me to this was the sideboard where you are just splashing for Invasive Surgery and Seal of Removal.
I see. That's very interesting. What is Seal of Removal for, you think, in this stack?
Creatures?
Okay. So I guess our sideboard is just like all like sort of pseudo hate cards or just like very efficient, like try to get their thing out of the way to kill them sort of cards.
Yeah. Well, also you can seal your own Bushwhacker to like double up on your pump turns and kill your opponent. So it has some like functionality on that front. Mm-hmm. But anyways, yeah, that deck is a nice little piece of history. The Kuldotha Red deck, the talk of the town, and then people discovered you could play Stoneforge Mystic.
I do remember putting in Batterskull versus those people, and they were always very unhappy.
That was a whole set later. You were doing it to the people who should have known better.
Well, yes, but that was what the PTQ season was. It was just like standard, and then they banned a million cards because the format was kind of cracked.
Yeah, a little bit. The other thing that will be cracking is us right on out of here after that. Dom will be back next week to give us a wonderful Pro Tour report, presumably, or a horrible one. It really depends. You know, it could go either way. He could win the whole thing, or he could already be asking for a deck to play on Sunday. It's really hard to tell.
Spoiler, he might have already done that in Boomer versus Zoomer.
It's fine. I'm sure everything is fine. You know, it's Wednesday before the Pro Tour. You always have these jitters. Please send any tweets of support to @DominHarvia. You know, he will probably be not listening at his Twitter too much between rounds of the Pro Tour, but if you would like to, you know, send him anything, do that. You can find us on Twitter, the podcast at least, @Dominaria_pod. You can find me @ARMLX. You can find Jarvis
@JKYU06.
Yep. You can find Jarvis, where else, Jarvis? Plug your content.
Twitch, you can find me there, JarvisU. You can find YouTube, also JarvisU. And I'm still on Medify. It's been kind of rough, but you can find me there. They technically took my name down from the search because I hadn't had a session in so long, but you can still navigate to it if you look hard enough. Oh, like, it should be like medify.com/ at Jarvis U.
Okay. You can find Dom producing content on StarCityGames.com. You can find me producing content for Channel Fireball /TCG Player. You can find the podcast on Patreon at Dominarias_judgment. And, you know, big shout out to our new patron, Jonathan, who did just that. You can find, you know, the podcast community out on Discord. There will be a link to that in the show notes, as well as there's a link to that pinned on our Twitter. And you can find me here next week, along with presumably Dom, unless the strangest travel catastrophe occurs, getting back from Minneapolis to Canada. Very close, but the worst things have happened, for sure. And we will be discussing, you know, presumably some wrap-up of the Pro Tour and anything else that comes up in the next week.